You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
Welcome back to Breaking Math. I'm your host, Autumn Phaneuf, and today we're joined once again by a man that needs no introduction, Professor Marcus DeSatoy. He holds the title of Oxford Simony Professor of the Public Understanding of Science. He is a mathematician, author, and someone who has been helping us rethink the role of mathematics in our daily lives. This time, we're diving into his latest book, Blueprints, How Mathematics Shapes Creativity, from Jackson Pollock's fractals to Shakespeare's use of prime numbers, from symmetry in Bach to randomness in modern design. Marcus shows us how the language of mathematics doesn't just describe the universe, it collaborates with creativity itself. Marcus, welcome back to Breaking Math. Out of curiosity, why did you choose the metaphor of blueprints, and how did you decide to capture all of these mathematics and art in this interplay?
Yeah, well, I guess the central idea of the whole book is that I think that mathematics is the study of structure. I think that's a very good description of how I view mathematics, and structure is also key to many artistic practices. I think a lot of people think that artists are just kind of emoting either musically or visually, but actually structure is incredibly important for them too. And so often the structures that they're interested in are things that I recognize as kind of mathematical in nature. And I thought that the word blueprint sort of captured that, because it's has the idea of some kind of framework within which you can, you know, build many versions of something or many different things based on kind of some underlying principles. So I quite like the idea of blueprint. I mean, blueprint is kind of very much at the heart of, for example, architecture or product design. So I sort of thought that blueprint was quite a sort of non-technical word, non-mathematical word, which sort of helped to underpin both kind of structures in mathematics and structures in the arts as well.
So in that case, since blueprints are the study of structure, how would you define creativity and its interplay?
Well, that's a very challenging, I think, question, because creativity is quite a slippery word. And, you know, I think it's a bit like consciousness. Trying to define consciousness is quite challenging. But for me, actually, the two are quite related, because I think creativity is kind of our species' tool to try and understand kind of our inner world, what it means to be human, our humanity's place within the natural world. And it's sort of creativity is, I think, going back to the psychologist Carl Rogers, who talked about creativity being humanity's best tool to understand this kind of idea of consciousness and our own inner worlds and the inner worlds of others. So I think the creativity is about trying to understand our place in the universe. And I suppose, you know, that's I think partly why mathematics and creativity are so mixed up, because creativity, if it's trying to understand our place in the universe and our relationship to it, and creativity is very often associated with, you know, maybe expressing things in a musical or a visual way. But I think that because mathematics is at the heart of how the natural world works, we're going to get this kind of interesting kind of interplay between the world of mathematics and the world of artistic creativity.
So if we're intersecting mathematics and creativity, does that make mathematicians collaborators with artists and not just interpreters?
Yeah, I think so. And I suppose, you know, I wrote this book partly out of all of the collaborations that I've had going back since I first started training as a mathematician. And, you know, I think this is a very personal book because it's sort of talking about a lot of the stories of times I've been either in the theatre space with people or the concert hall. And I think that, I suppose, secretly, perhaps I wanted to be these creative artists. That may have been partly what this book is about, my fantasy that, you know, I would have loved to have been a composer or an architect. But I think what I've loved over the years of being a mathematician is that, you know, I've kept those interests and those collaborations very live. And so I think that when I am working with, say, a composer, for example, have set up a centre at the Royal Northern College of Music here in Manchester, in the UK, with a composer. We call it PRISM. It stands for Practice and Research in Science and Music. Is that I think that, you know, it is very, the work that I do at the heart of that is very much a collaboration between mathematician and composer. I mean, for example, with Emily Howard, the composer, we actually composed a string quartet together, which explores the connections between the idea of mathematical proof and musical composition. That I feel very often a musical composition feels a bit like piecing together a mathematical proof that takes you on a journey and you arrive at somewhere new. So I think that I certainly see it as a collaboration. And I suppose what's interesting is that, you know, quite often when I talk to artists and begin the work we do together, they're very skeptical about whether we're going to find a connection. And some are less so. I think there are some who are very obviously courting me as a mathematician because they know that I'm likely to have some interesting structures that will be interesting to stimulate their creativity. But often I'll find that, you know, those collaborations start with just not really knowing that they have a lot of mathematics at the heart of their practice. And as we work, they'll say, well, this is the thing I'm sort of interested in. And I'll go, well, but I recognize that. That's really fascinating because that's, for me, a mathematical structure. So it's quite exciting. I think one of the themes that comes out in the book quite a lot is the interesting tension where is a creative artist aware of the fact that they're creating mathematics? And sometimes they are very deliberately, perhaps using mathematical ideas in their work. But I think sometimes what's more interesting is when a creative artist sort of explores something for its own aesthetic value and through that process almost rediscovers or perhaps discovers for the first time mathematical ideas. So, you know, for example, I have a chapter about fractals and Jackson Pollock is a great example of an artist who wasn't aware that he was doing mathematics. But if you analyze his paintings, you find that they have a very sort of special mathematical signature, which is the geometric patterns he makes by this kind of drip painting technique are actually fractal in quality. The fact that they kind of have infinite complexity. So I think this is why Jackson Pollock is so exciting. You stand in front of a Pollock and it's very hard to judge the scale. You don't know whether you're close or far away. And that's the work the fractal characteristic is doing. It's giving you a sense of almost falling into the painting. And we've actually used this signature of the fractal quality of his painting to identify genuine Pollocks versus fake Pollocks, because it's actually quite hard to do. You think, well, surely a Pollock would be easy to make. I just flick paint around. But that generally would create something which isn't fractal, because our arm is a bit like a pendulum, and pendulums are very regular. But Jackson Pollock's painting style was very different. He used his arm all the way up to his shoulder and was moving that around. And that creates something which we call a double pendulum, a chaotic pendulum. And the signature of chaos is the fractal. So his painting style produced something quite special. But he wasn't aware of that. So, he died before anybody understood the unique quality of his paintings are that they have this fractal geometric structure. And I think, going back to the idea that, creativity is about understanding our place in the universe, this is exactly, we can see this in Pollock's work, because Pollock was, in a sense, capturing the fact that nature is fractal at heart, the way that nature grows things. I went to Pollock's studio. It's sits in the middle of a forest.
Is the rumor true that you have your background of your wallpaper on your computer as Jackson Pollock's
farm? It was so fascinating because he puts the canvases down on the floor and then he flicks the paint around. So the floor itself in his studio is, a missing Pollock, because it's just covered in drip painting. And so I took a really nice low shot of the floor, and I now have that as the desktop to my computer. So, it's all the paint that didn't go on the canvas. It went on the floor. But, his studio is surrounded by trees, which are fractal in quality. You have big branch, then it branches and smaller branches. And it has this kind of interesting sort of scaleless property where the small things look like copies of the big things. So I think that he was responding to the fact that he saw around him fractals. He didn't know that those were mathematical shapes, but he wanted to make an abstract version of that. And we have this mathematical measure of how fractal something is, this fractal dimension. So one thinks of a line as one dimensional and the a solid figure is two-dimensional, but fractals are sort of somewhere in between, because they're not really a line, but they're trying to fill the space, the canvas, but they're also not just, a block of paint. So we can actually measure, and I talk about this in the book, a way of measuring, how fractal something is. And what's rather beautiful is that the paintings of Pollock that we love the most are those with a fractal dimension which is closest to the fractal dimension of nature. If it's a little less, we find them too simplistic, too much, and it's too complex. And so one of the reasons that we're responding to Pollock's work is that he's sort of abstractly capturing nature. But we really needed this kind of code and of mathematics to truly sort of understand what was going on. Yet Pollock didn't deliberately put that in. I take a Pollock and then I zoom in and I ask people, can you tell which is the original and which is the... I mean, obviously, when you get up to a certain point, the fractal quality has to go, because you start to see the spots of paint. And that's also another really interesting tension that comes out in the book quite often as well, is that often the kind of mathematics might be perfect, but the realization of it often is necessarily an approximation.
I noticed that you go through the book and you end up talking about circles a lot, and also some structural configurations behind the circle when building a sphere in real life. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the circle is so interesting. I mean, I sort of, the first two blueprints are almost like the blueprints of number, prime numbers, and the blueprint of geometry, which I think, the circle is somehow the beginning of it all. And it is a structure that humanity has been obsessed with really ever since we've started creating. Here in the UK, we have amazing examples of stone circles, which are, thousands of years old. And I think, again, the circle is a shape that we were encountering all the time. The sun is circle, the moon going from circle to disappearing and back to circle, the ripples in water I mean, I suppose even our eyes are examples, you know. So if you're looking into deep into somebody else's soul, you're looking through a circle. So again, you know, the circle is, you know, so fundamental to the natural world. But you can say, yes, but those stone circles certainly aren't exact circles. I mean, they're an approximation to a circle. And that kind of leads you on into whether there is anywhere a true circle. And, you know, we now believe the universe, according to quantum physics, is quantized in nature. So everything comes in little bits. It's kind of pixelated rather than, you know, continuous. And that means that any attempt at doing a circle will probably always be an approximation. And I suppose that goes back to, you know, Plato, his idea of, and I talk about Plato quite a bit in the book, because often his ideas are that, you know, there's the Platonic realm where these structures can exist in the mind. And then, you know, what are we as humans? We are.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
Looking at the shadows in the cave of those structures, and they will always be an approximation of the kind of pure mathematical shapes. And he, actually, Plato was always rather dismissive of art. In he felt that that was an approximation of the approximation, that art was never going to capture the pure kind of beauty or of the abstract mathematical realm. So it's interesting that kind of tension about, and it does sort of highlight one of my big theses, which is I think that the universe is a physicalized piece of mathematics, that those structures of mathematics, the blueprints of mathematics, the circle, prime numbers, fractals, exist before ever the universe came into existence. And, you know, maybe that's kind of if one's trying to look for something very spiritual, you know, that mathematics is the beginning of it all. And why we are seeing so much mathematics whenever we try and kind of explore the physical world around us, because it is kind of a piece of mathematics at its heart.
You also talk a lot about prime numbers in the book, and you share everything from stories on gear theory. And also, what's the story behind calling your twins 41 and 43?
Yeah, well, I suppose prime numbers, you know, is part of my own mathematical research. So they're very much something that I'm very passionate about. They're still a mystery. We don't understand these numbers. And so let me give you an example of something we don't understand, which is we know that there are infinitely many of these indivisible numbers. So the primes are sort of like the periodic table of mathematics. They are what build all other numbers. We know there are infinitely many of them, but what's curious is that every now and again, we see two numbers coming up, which are like both prime. I mean, obviously you have to be odd. The only even prime is number two. That's the odd one out. So the closest two prime numbers can be together is like two apart. So, for example, 17 and 19 or 41 and 43. And we believe, but we don't know, this is still an open problem, that there are infinitely many of what are we call twin primes. So, but we don't know the answer to that. That's really, primes get rarer and rarer as we go through the universe of numbers. Yet every now and again, so they should be kind of spreading out, but we think that infinitely often you'll keep on seeing these little twins. So the reason I wanted to call my daughters 41 and 43 is because they are identical twins, and I thought that would be quite cute to name them after 41 and 43. But my wife put her foot down and said, no, we can't do that. It's a bit Elon Musk-y.
It was quite American.
Well, it's before Elon Musk was even on the scene. But anyway, they're my secret names for them. But, you know, the reason they come up in the kind of the world of creativity is very interesting because, as you said, you mentioned gears there. One of the things you don't want very often with gears is that they wear each other down because you keep on getting, you know, teeth meeting each other too often. And the point about primes and why they're quite often interesting from a sort of creative point of view is the primes allow you to keep things out of sync. Means that let me give you the example, which is actually the first story in the book, which is about the French composer Olivier Messiaen, because he has a wonderful piece. It's probably the most iconic piece of the 20th century called The Quartet for the End of Time, which is very famous because he wrote it whilst he was prisoner of war in Stalag 8A during the Second World War. And the first performance was in the prisoner of war camp by him as a prisoner and three other prisoners. So it was performed, you know, in January 41, 40, I think. But it was, you know, an incredibly famous performance. But what's so interesting is the piano part. This is the part that Messiaen was playing, because he wanted to create this kind of weird effect of somehow something repeating, but you never kind of feel it repeats. And so what he does is he has a 17-note rhythm sequence, which does repeat itself over and over again. It sort of starts just crotchet, 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 then goes into a lovely syncopated rhythm, crotchet, minim, then just repeats. So that could be very boring. But he has a 29-note harmonic sequence. So the chords that are played, 29 chords, and then they repeat, 29 chords. Again, could be very boring. But when you put the two together, something very interesting happens, because here's how the primes keep things out of sync. 17 and 29. So when the rhythm is finished, it starts again. The harmony hasn't finished. It's working its way through its 29 chords. Then the 29 chords start again, but the rhythm is somewhere completely different. So every time you hear the chord sequence, it's played with a completely different rhythm. And just think if Messiaen had chosen 15 and 30. That wouldn't work, because immediately you'd have the 15 rhythms, and the chords, when they start again, would just repeat. So the thing just repeats very quickly. But the 17 and 29, Messiaen has used that to keep the whole thing just never quite repeating, yet it's built out of something with this repetition. So that's a beautiful way that Messiaen used the kind of indivisibility of the primes to create this kind of musical effect. And here's another example. I did some work with a composer that worked with Olivier Messiaen, George Benjamin. And I asked him, I'm very interested. Messiaen has so much interesting mathematics throughout his music. And actually, Messiaen is a character that pops up in the book in quite a few different places in the world of symmetry. And he is one of my favorite composers. But George Benjamin said, no, he had no mathematical training at all, but he was drawn to these structures for their aesthetic value. So he almost discovered the importance of the indivisibility of primes through his musical exploration, which I think is kind of rather beautiful. But there's a lovely way that these primes... I mean, I love this chapter, The Primes, and I think it sort of captures one of the qualities of the book, which when I wrote it, I really enjoyed, which is starting with a mathematical structure, understanding how different artistic practices kind of realize this structure in such different ways. So you've got it happening in music with Messiaen, but when you come to architecture, these primes are used in acoustics. So a concert hall very often has prime dimensions precisely again to make sure things don't come into sync. So when sounds bounce off what you don't want in a concert hall is reverberation or dead places in the auditorium. And the use of primes means that the sound waves never kill each other. They don't reinforce and you get a really big boom. But then you come to something like literature. How are primes used in literature? And I think this was actually one of my biggest surprises. That
doesn't Shakespeare use that as well?
Yeah, Shakespeare. You would never expect... Everyone thinks of Shakespeare as a wordsmith. What on earth has he got to do with numbers?
But actually, there's a lot.
Yes, there is a lot, exactly. But I think that was a surprise, actually, to me. And I mean, there's obvious, because he's a poet, poetry has a lot of mathematical structure in it. But I think the surprise for me was how he was using these numbers. So everyone knows that Shakespeare writes in iambic pentameter, which is 10 syllables, 5 groups of 2, short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long. Is a very, that's a very recognizable. The iambic pentameter is actually used by a lot of different poets at the time. But when he wants you to really take notice, he changes that. And instead of using 10 divisible number, 5s and 2s, he uses an 11 beat structure. So what's the most famous line in Shakespeare? To be or not to be, that is the question. If you count those up, it's one more. It's 11. It's a prime number. And it kind of disrupts your sense of rhythm. 11 doesn't fall naturally. He's using that to wake you up. You know, you kind of soporifically being lulled into a sense of sleepiness by iambic pentameter. And then he says, okay, no, but this is the most important speech in the play. And he uses that 11. In contrast, he uses the number 7 whenever magic is being used. Actually, one of my favorite plays is Midsummer Night's Dream. It was something I actually performed in when I was a student in Oxford. And of course, there's lots of magic in Midsummer Night's Dream.
He uses a clustering of 5-7-5 going throughout.
Well, actually, the 5-7-5 is kind of interesting. I mean, actually, it's mostly sevens for magic. So
okay.
So, for example, here's Puck as he takes the magic potion, which gets all the lovers to fall in love with the different people. So, Churl, upon thine eyes I throw all the power this charm doth owe. When thou wakest, let love forbid sleep his seat on thy eyelid. It goes down from that 10 to 7. And even when the other place where there's magic, the witch is in Macbeth, when shall we three meet again? And these odd numbers were really kind of challenging the king at the time during that period. Obviously, Elizabeth I was the principal member of royalty for Shakespeare, but there was a ban on using any poetry which had odd numbers in it. And this was partly because, we like something with an even rhythm to it. And so it felt very somehow a carriage with a leaky a wheel or something, that it didn't feel right. So it's quite a challenge. And, Shakespeare, I mean, it's at a time, if you think about the period of Shakespeare, it's a really exciting time scientifically, because you've got Shakespeare probably heard about the ideas of Galileo and Copernicus about the shift of the Earth not being at the center, the sun being at the center. And I think if you look at the later plays, you can see quite a bit of influence of those new scientific ideas that I think Cymbeline, for example, you can really read as a statement of this change in our perspective. And there is some evidence that he probably was friends with John Dee, who was the kind of court mathematician in the Elizabethan period. And John Dee was one of the first to publish an edition of Euclid's Elements. So mathematics was certainly in the air. And I think Shakespeare probably was doing that deliberately. Here's an example, I think, unlike the Messiaen and the Pollock, of somebody who knew what they were doing. This wasn't intuition. I think he really understood how he was disrupting things.
To shift this a little bit, can you go into some of the details on how music usually has a tempo of 4-4, but there are other folks that use 5-5 or some also regularities?
Yeah. Well, I suppose of all of the creative arts, people often talk about this connection between mathematics and music as being the strongest connection. And I think there are many reasons for that. You've already kind of alluded to the idea of rhythm being one of them. But I gave a definition right at the beginning of mathematics being the study of structure. Another one I often give is mathematics is the science of patterns. And I often say that I think the music is the art of patterns, and the word pattern is really important to both practices. And I think that's why when you're listening to music, I mean, music is very abstract in its nature. The way the brain kind of navigates the musical world is spotting these patterns and noticing when something has changed but is related to what you've just seen. And I suppose this is one of the ways that mathematics and music have a very close bond, is that, and there's something you see very often in the way that Bach writes his music, is that if you're doing like theme and variations, you've got a theme and then you want to somehow change it up a little bit, but you want that variation to be connected to the theme. So often a musician will use ideas of symmetry in order to do those variations. So when a theme might go up, you might very often hear it kind of cascade down, almost like in a mirror symmetry, or it might invert the thing in a different way or transpose it. So you see lots of ideas of symmetry at work, especially in Bach's music, in sort of that idea of theme and variations. But it, actually, right back to the...
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
The notes we use to make music have at their heart mathematics. And this goes right back to Pythagoras, who understood, why do we find some things harmonic and other things discordant? And he started experimenting and understood that the notes that we like, that we find harmonic, actually have a very simple, fundamental mathematical relationship. So if you play a note on a guitar, I have a guitar behind me, play a note on a guitar and then half the length of the string, the note almost sounds the same. And we call this the octave. And the ear is responding to the fact that there's a 1-to-2 relationship between the wavelengths. The length and the half produces something which almost feels the same note. And then if you mix that up and take a third of the length of the string, then we get something called the perfect fifth, which is the building block of all harmonic music. And that's what Pythagoras understood. If you use these kind of harmonic pairs to build up music, it leads to the fact that this octave very mathematically naturally deserves to be divided up into 12 notes. So anyone who plays the piano, for example, will see these 12 pattern of 12 great white and black notes, and you see it repeated. And you might ask, well, why did we divide it up into 12 and not, you know, why didn't we go decimal and do 10? Well, there's a very mathematical reason, because the ear is responding to this, the fact that we find two notes harmonically beautiful and interesting when they have this mathematical relationship.
You also mentioned in the book that some of the artists like Salvador Dali reach for mathematics to explore spiritual or transcendent type art.
Yes.
Go into that a little bit, because I found that fascinating. It's kind of the absolute opposite of Jackson Pollock.
Yes, and I think it's a very good example of an artist who sought out mathematical ideas for their inspiration. Pollock discovered them intuitively. Dali, in contrast, was hugely inspired by spending time with scientists. And he used to say, you know, I'd rather swim in the hot water of science than the cold water of art. And he used to have salons where he would invite scientists around and find out about what the current exciting ideas were. And you can see that very obviously in many of his paintings, his obsession with Einstein's theory of relativity and the nature of the flexibility of time. So we see these clock faces that are sort of warping. He was very obsessed with the idea of DNA. So we see DNA spirals running through his work. But the mathematical things that I found very interesting were that he was very interested in the idea of mathematicians talking about shapes in higher dimensions, in four dimensions. And actually, a lot of artists found this kind of discussion really stimulating. And you can see why. It's going into the realm of the imagination, it seems like. What is a four-dimensional cube look like? So Dali has this extraordinary painting, which is... we can't make a four-dimensional cube because we live in three spatial dimensions. But just in the same way as a three-dimensional cube can be unwrapped into a two-dimensional net from which we can then fold up and make a three-dimensional cube, mathematicians understood that a four-dimensional cube can be unwrapped to a net in three dimensions, which if you put it in the four-dimensional world, you could fold up to make a four-dimensional cube. Now, this net of a four-dimensional cube is rather beautiful because it's, if you think about the net of a three-dimensional cube, what is it? It's a cross shape. It's four squares stacked, you know, on top of each other with two squares either side, and you fold those up and make a cube. So the net of a four-dimensional cube is a stack of four three-dimensional cubes on top of each other, and then you have four cubes arranged around the top of that shape. For Dali, when he saw that, it's often given the name of a tesseract. He saw this unwrapped four-dimensional cube, and it looked like a cross. It looks like two intersecting crosses, basically. And so there's this beautiful painting that he did of Christ on the hypercube, this unwrapped four-dimensional cube. For me, I think, you see, one of the things which was very important to Dali was his spiritual and religious side. So for Dali, I think this idea of a hidden other dimension that we can't see so resonated with him for a spiritual dimension that the mathematics was being used there to sort of give a hint of, yes, we have these shapes, but there is something beyond that that we can't see. And for Dali, that was a kind of four dimensions for him. He could make sense as a spiritual dimension. The other person who comes up quite a lot in the book as well, an author that is one of my favorite authors, is Borges. And Borges, again, he read a lot about four-dimensional geometry, read a lot about infinity. That comes a lot in his short stories. But I think that Borges, like Dali, didn't really have the technical mathematical language to understand what these things were. So he used his own language, which was the language of storytelling. Dali used his own language, which is the language of painting. And I think this is so exciting, you know, that although we're trying to understand our universe, but we find our own particular languages that are best suited for us to navigate that. And for Borges, it was storytelling. And so although he didn't quite understand what a four-dimensional shape was, in one of his stories, he tells us about a library. He was actually a librarian at one stage in his life. And he talks about a library and the librarian stuck inside this library. And the librarian wants to work out, what is the shape of my library? And he talks about the library being everything. There is nothing outside the library. The universe, the library is the universe. So actually what Borges is doing in that story is trying to understand actually the shape of our universe. But he does it through this more tangible thing of the library. The library shape is described as like made out of, the rooms are hexagons, so it's kind of beehive. And there are many floors going up and down. But then Borges, his librarian, sort of starts to speculate, well, does it just go on forever? Or is there a limit? Is there some point where I hit a wall? But then that raises a question, what's behind the wall? But the universe, the library is everything. So he says it can't be that. And eventually he comes up with this solution that maybe I, when I travel sort of in one direction, eventually I come back to where I started. And perhaps when I travel out in a different direction, I just keep on coming back to where I started. And even when I go up through the floors above, I suddenly find myself returning to the floor I started in. If you understand this and analyze it mathematically, Borges in that story has actually constructed a four-dimensional torus, or a donut shape, you know, like Homer Simpson donut, but a four-dimensional one where somehow all of these loops are like going around the four-dimensional shape. And that's what's so beautiful. You know, he's used this story to actually create a four-dimensional, the library is kind of the surface of a four-dimensional torus. Amazing.
It absolutely is. And one other thing that I found very interesting in literature was talking about Tom Stoppard's Acadia.
Oh, yes.
And is it more well-suited to exploring mathematics concepts through structure rather than content?
Well, I think theater is one of my other big passions. And I think that theater is a lovely space to kind of experiment and try things out that perhaps wouldn't work if you were trying to be too literal. So I think that I enjoy working with theatre companies a lot, and I talk about that quite often in the book, because it's almost more like a mathematical space than say film, which I think is like has to be perhaps truer to reality than perhaps theatre is. I mean, you can create, and I talk in the book about the amazing worlds that the Marvel Universe creates using fractals, for example. But there's still a sort of, it has to be believably real. Whilst in the theatre, you suspend your disbelief and can explore, I think, things which are more abstract in nature. So Arcadia is kind of interesting because you mentioned structure and content. I think Arcadia is beautiful because it has both. Arcadia is certainly has content, talking about the ideas of fractals and chaos theory, Thomasina, the young woman at the heart of the play, essentially discovers the ideas of chaos and fractals. But because she's not in the computer age, this is, you know, I think it's 18th century, it's set in, she doesn't have the tools to genuinely understand what's going on. And we only really discovered the ideas of fractals when we had a computer to experiment and just make things like the Mandelbrot set. So certainly there, what's lovely is that a discussion of, for example, the impact that the butterfly effect might have on history. I mean, the idea that, you know, just a small change in the narrative could have huge implications. And so Stoppard certainly embeds that into the story of Arcadia, that if one thing had changed, the story would have been completely different. But I think structurally, what I find most exciting, so the content is kind of the most obvious place to explore mathematical ideas, but Tom Stoppard, I think, goes one further, because I think that he actually makes the play mathematically structural at heart and fractal, that what you see is the play is sort of two time frames, 20th century and I think it's 18th century. And the historical story is mapped out over 3 years, whilst the 20th century story is over 3 days. So you already have this kind of scaling effect, and you just see repetition of ideas through the historical period reflected and condensed in the the modern period. And so I think Stoppard is really genuinely sort of trying to make a mathematical fractal structure to the play that it has at its heart, also the content. Another play that I really love, which I think does this superbly, is Michael Frayn's Copenhagen, which is a play exploring, again, the idea of history and the idea that not about chaos theory, but about quantum physics, that every time you observe and try and understand a scene from history, somehow every time you observe it, it could do something different. And so in Copenhagen, he repeats this meeting between Heisenberg and Bohr that happens in Copenhagen. And we never, I mean, historically, we don't know quite what happened at that meeting. And we don't know, was it Heisenberg warning Bohr about the nuclear program? Was it Heisenberg trying to get some help with the Nazi program? And what's lovely is that, you know, here's ideas of quantum physics, which is at the heart of what Heisenberg and Bohr did. But Michael Frayn, the play is a kind of experiment in quantum physics, because he just, you repeat the scene over and over again. And every time you do the scene, it's different. It's a bit like every time I look at the electron, it goes through a different slit. So I love when a playwright goes that one step further and not only has science or mathematics as content, but can they actually realize it as structure?
Now, what kind of stories do numbers actually tell us versus some of the stories that artists will tell us? I know that there's a lot of crossover, but where are these distinct differences? Both are perfectly imperfect in their own sense.
One of the words that for me became quite important in distinguishing, for example, the mathematician's practice versus the artist's practice, perhaps is the word ambiguity. You know, ambiguity for a mathematician is anathema. We like to really pin things down for us all to understand simultaneously that there are infinitely many primes. There shouldn't be any question at the end of telling that story that everyone understands, oh, yeah, there are infinitely many primes. Yet for an artist, I think ambiguity is quite an important, that they want to allow space for each person encountering their work to bring something of their own to the story. So there has to be sort of perhaps that room. And often, you know, an artist will hide the way they've used a structure. So they will want to challenge you maybe with trying to kind of unpick, you know, why is this thing working so brilliantly? And they often will not reveal, although, you know, frankly, mathematicians can suffer from this as well. So I think, you know, Gauss very famously enjoyed sort of pulling rabbits out of hats, and people go, how on earth did you come up with that mathematical idea? And he very famously once said, an architect does not leave up the scaffolding once he's finished the building. The idea being, you don't necessarily need to show how you came up with the thing. But on the other hand, you know, in some sense you do. I mean, a proof is all about removing any question that this thing might be true or might be false. Whilst I suppose in maybe the arts, that's more interesting to have that openness.
There's always that little bit of mystery in both.
Yeah. Well, yes. You know, for me, the reason I come to my desk every morning to do mathematics is not the things I know or the things we've discovered, but the mysteries which still remain. So they are certainly, you know, a massive drive for me in my own creativity. And I should say, you know, one of the important messages of this book is that mathematics actually has perhaps more in common with the creative arts than many people realize, in the sense that it is hugely creative in nature. The way that we come up with our discoveries, our proofs, requires a real kind of aesthetic, artistic mindset. And I think, you know, that's important for me. I think, you know, some people worry when you talk about maths and music, am I trying to take the emotion out of music and make just cold clinical maths? Often I'm trying to do sort of the reverse of that, which is I'm trying to show that mathematics often in its nature is very emotional, and actually the reason we like some maths and call other things just boring arithmetic is because there's a very interesting story being told by the mathematical journey. So I think that that relates to the motivation for doing mathematics is often trying to unravel these mysteries. And I suppose, you know, that's probably the motivation of many artists, is that the mystery is often, our fellow humans are the mystery of where we've come from, what's going to happen next, death, life. Those mysteries are what drive, many creative practices. So I think, we're both driven by mystery as the reason for wanting to be creative.
Now, this is a little more personal of a question for this, but if you had to pick one blueprint that best captures you both as a mathematician and lover of the arts, what would it be?
That's like trying to, yeah, that's really difficult. But I suppose two probably come to mind, partly because the two things which I'm obsessed with are prime numbers, which we talked a little bit about. But the other one is symmetry. My mathematical research is trying to understand the world of symmetry, what symmetries could exist. And I think symmetry is an interesting blueprint which comes up a lot in music. Symmetry is very often, you'll find it in the way that Bach develops his music, or Messiaen created some very interesting new scales which are symmetrical at heart. You find it used so often, well, across the architectural world, from Palladio, loved using symmetry, and it's the reason we feel so, I think, content when we're in a Palladian building, is we're responding to that symmetry. And again, here we see this connection, mathematics, the arts, and nature, because one of the things we find in nature is symmetry is so important to the way nature grows things. And so I think we're often responding to symmetry in the world of the arts because it resonates with the symmetries that we see in the natural world around us.
Okay. So there was one story that I noticed in the book about randomness, and you were tiling the floor of your kitchen. Can you tell us more about randomness in everyday life, or even what you ended up doing with the different tiles?
Yeah, because this is the blueprint that I finished the book with, which is the blueprint of randomness, which almost is an anti-blueprint, because everything else up to that point is sort of is about structure, and randomness seems to be positively the opposite. It's about something having no structure. But what we've discovered is that randomness does have patterns and structure. And one of the interesting questions is, when is something random? When is it not? We have signatures for when something seems to be genuinely random. And one of the interesting signatures is that often randomness likes to clump things together. Buses are random. And one of the reasons, you're waiting for a bus, there's a big gap, and then three come together, is you're experiencing that randomness. And there was a very interesting artist that I encountered when I was doing the work with a visual artist, which is Gerhard Richter. Gerhard Richter had actually a piece which is exploring randomness as a tool for creativity. And what he did was to take a 5x5 grid and then just randomly pick colors from a sack. He had 25 colors in there, and he would just randomly pick one, and then the first square would be blue, and then he'd put it back, and then he'd pick another one, it'd be red, and then and he created 196 of these canvases. And I was asked by the curator of the gallery which displayed these to give a talk about this. And and I use it, actually, 196 is actually interesting, because it enables you, that's enough data to genuinely test, was Richter truly being random? Or did he go, no, I don't quite like that, I'm going to change that, I'm going to cheat and make that red blue because it looks nicer. And so I did a statistical analysis on Richter's canvases, and very interestingly, it passed all the tests of randomness. For example, quite often you see three yellows in a row, and often people will see that and go, ooh, that looks interesting. That seems to be, is that saying something? Or if there's a little cross figure, it reveals that we are so obsessed with finding patterns and meaning that even when something is random, we will try and give it meaning. So now, coming back to the tiles that you mentioned, so actually they're not on the floor, they're on my wall. But I was working with an artist we developed these beautiful tiles which have different colors on them and different dimensions. And my kitchen was the first place where we actually use these tiles. And so I thought, well, you know, one could do something interesting, like some sort of interesting pattern or maybe spell out something. But I thought, no, let's try and do a kind of Richter and do them randomly around the wall. And so I laid them out. And when my wife came down to see how they were laid out, she said, oh, no, that's terrible. Look, you've got three reds together. I said, yeah, that's what you get with randomness. She said, no, I can't have a kitchen with three red tiles all together. And she started sort of rearranging them. And in the end, actually, our kitchen is a great example of what looks like it's random. But if you're a mathematician, you can actually read that and say, no, somebody has had influence on this because it's missing quite a few characteristics of what should be random.
Very, very interesting. Whenever you think of that, you think of, even if you're looking at graph theory, take a step back, you look at these little clusters, even if they are random. And sometimes you'll see a dyad or a triad or a supernode of something.
Yeah.
So wouldn't you always see that in randomness as well?
Yeah, I think that's why randomness is quite interesting as a vehicle for an artist to take them somewhere new, because that randomness might lead to something which is which has more meaning in it. And then you can start to maybe develop that. So I think the other book I wrote, which has a lot of exploration of creativity, is The Creativity Code, about the way that AI can be creative. And very often AI is using perhaps some randomness components in its generative process. But that's fine, because that could often stimulate an artist to go, you know, I'm going to use this thing, and then it's offering me something that then takes me on a different journey. So, I think that's often how randomness is used, as, you know, I've got stuck, let's just mix things up, see what happens. But then, you know, you won't just stay with the randomness will take you to the next step of something you perhaps weren't seeing without the use of it.
Now, was there anything that you found extremely interesting or that you didn't expect when researching the book? I noticed in the back you have a very long bibliography.
Yes, I mean, I did a lot of research, and it's based on a lot of the years that I've spent working with artists. So, I start the book with another long list, which is the dramatis personae. So I actually, you know, after I finished the book, I realized, wow, what a journey this book takes you on through, you know, so many different periods of history, different sorts of artists. And so I thought it'd be fun just to list the journey that people will go on. I think I suppose one of the most exciting things was studying a piece of music by a Greek composer called Yannis Xenakis, who uses the symmetries of a cube for structuring this piece. It's a bit like a theme and variations piece. But when I started to analyze what Xenakis had done, he actually used a structure in symmetry that I'd never seen before. In fact, nobody has ever explored this idea before. So that's what's really beautiful, is that this isn't a one-way dialogue. This is a one-way process. This is a dialogue where often a creative artist can start to explore something which might stimulate me as a mathematician. So one of my research projects that I'm working on at the moment really has its genesis in the work I did trying to understand this solo cello piece by Yannis Xenakis. And that was a surprise, because I thought, it would be all things I knew and telling those stories, but that sort of discoveries that Xenakis was making through music has set me off on my own new direction of research.
That's absolutely wonderful. Now, as we're wrapping up here, is there anything that you want listeners or viewers to take away from this conversation or even know about math?
I think one of the things that I think is really important is not to expect to understand everything. I think that mathematics almost suffers from the fact that, you know, we can show all the working, we can show all our steps. And sometimes that limits us in being able to sort of jump forward and try and understand just a feeling for kind of something. So, I'm not shy in this book about showing people some mathematics. But what I hope is that even when people don't understand all the details, that they'll just at least get some sort of feeling for what's going on. After all, I think when I first started reading Shakespeare, I didn't understand very much of it at all. But as I spent more time with it, it made more and more sense. But I still, that just from the very early readings of Shakespeare, you fall in love with the power of the English language to tell amazing stories. And so I think always what I hope is that that people will approach mathematics in an open manner, as if they're listening to a piece of music for the first time, which they will not understand all the details and they won't retain everything, but they'll get a feeling for what's going on, and hopefully it will inspire them to come back and spend more time trying to understand things in more detail.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And it was such a pleasure having you. And that's it for today's episode of Breaking Math. A huge thank you to you, Professor Desatoy, for joining us and sharing how mathematics weaves itself into music, art, theater, and even the tiles on your kitchen wall. And if today's episode sparked your curiosity, be sure to check out his latest book, Blueprints, and see how numbers and structures can transform the way you experience creativity. You can find more episodes, transcripts, and resources on breakingmath.io and connect with us across all social media platforms, which are in the caption below. Thanks for listening. And remember, math isn't just about numbers. It's about the patterns and mysteries that shape our world. Until next time, stay curious and stay informed.